I'd like to welcome everybody to the Parsha class for our Mishpatim, 57-68. Last week, in our class on Yisro, which is the Parsha that contains the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, we discussed three broad areas of Judaism and their relative prioritization, if you will. We talked about the area of Jewish philosophy and hashkafa, outlook. Those are the ideas of the mind, which people like to ponder. Is there a God? How much does he know? Does he know what I'm thinking? Do I really have free choice? Those kinds of questions. That's one area. The other area is the area of performing the act of commandments, which we all are familiar with, the holidays, the prayers, all of the how-tos of Judaism, the active Judaism. And then the third area of Limud HaTorah, or study of the Torah, which is really in a category of its own. And we discussed the pros and the cons of each one. Of course, they're all vital and all important, but to become aware of the power that each one has if emphasized, or the lack thereof. I'm not going to go into that again. We certainly came out with a strong plug for Torah study being a primary focus and emphasis in Judaism if it is to be effective to really enable us to grow along the path of the Mesilas Yesharim, the path of the just, which is our theme for the year. But what comes next? After we have engaged in these three areas, what does the Torah turn our attention to next? Those three areas are all subsumed within the experience of Matan Torah, receiving the Torah. What's the next order of business? Parashas Mishpatim. The laws, the ordinances, the civil laws primarily, although there are others that are thrown in. But Mishpatim is primarily a display of laws that govern interpersonal relations with property, man to man, in other words, including bodily injury, property damage, theft, certain laws of marriage. That's what Mishpatim is. As soon as we leave Yisro, it's very obvious and very clear that we are entering into a very legalistic, a very technical parsha. And what is the message that the Torah is trying to teach us, and how does that play in the Mesilas Yesharim? I'd like you to join me for a short but a little technical Talmud lesson. There is a scenario given in the Mishnah, the oral law, of, we'll try to make this as simple as we can. Let's say there's two men, Reuven and Shimon. Reuven is walking down the street, and in the middle of the street, Shimon has placed a pottery jug that's filled with something, wine or oil. It's sitting there in the middle of the street, and Reuven is walking down. He doesn't see the jug, and he trips over it. Now, that scenario is divided further into two different scenarios. What happened when Reuven tripped over Shimon's jug? Scenario number one is that Reuven broke Shimon's jug. Scenario number two is that Reuven got hurt on Shimon's jug. Okay? What is the ruling in these two cases? So the Mishnah says that in scenario number one, when Reuven breaks Shimon's jug, Reuven is what we call putter, exempt. He's not responsible to reimburse Shimon for the broken jug. In scenario number two, where Reuven gets hurt on Shimon's jug, Shimon is held responsible to reimburse Reuven for his injury. And does that sound consistent, internally consistent? The two scenarios. What is the common thread?
Stumbling block.
Okay, so whose problem
Shimon
is it?
Is responsible.
Shimon's responsibility. It is not Reuven's responsibility. Because the jug was in the middle of the public thoroughfare, it shouldn't have been there, and Reuven is not held responsible for what happens. And Shimon is. Okay, that's the Mishnah. Comes along the Gemara. Gemara is the analysis of the Mishnah. And has an objection to the ruling that we just mentioned. And here's how the objection goes. In scenario number one, why is Reuven exempt from paying for the broken jug? He should have watched where he was going. End of objection. End of objection. The objection was only as it pertained to scenario number one. The objection said, why shouldn't Reuven be responsible for breaking the jug because he wasn't watching where he was going? There is no objection about scenario number two. There is no objection that says, why is Reuven allowed to collect compensation when he got injured? Because he should have been watching where he was going. He shouldn't hold Shimon responsible for his injury. He should have watched where he was going. The objection is only pertinent to scenario number one, where Reuven was the damager, not when Reuven was the damagee. Now let's distill that, and then we will make our point. The point was that the Gemara did not have a problem with Reuven being careless or negligent when it came to his own injury. That's okay. We don't think Reuven is so responsible for that. But we do have a problem with Reuven being careless when it comes to damaging another person's property. Says one of the great commentaries of the Talmud, we learn from here a very important lesson, a very important moral lesson. The moral lesson is, Torah morality, that is, the moral lesson is that it is much more incumbent for a person to be vigilant when it comes to damaging other people than when it comes to protecting his own well-being. In other words, when a person wakes up and goes outside on the street, he's got two things on his mind. We do this subconsciously. We have to watch where we're going, so A, we should not cause any damage, and B, so that we shouldn't get hurt ourselves. Whenever you're in a car, there's always the offensive and the defensive. To be careful that I don't cause damage, and I have to be careful that I don't get damaged. Says the Tosfos, from this little interchange in the Gemara, we learn that a person has to be more concerned that he doesn't cause damage than that he doesn't get damaged. Is that intuitive to everyone here? Or, let me phrase it another way. When we get on the street, are we more worried about our well-being that we shouldn't get hurt, or that we shouldn't hurt others? Open the floor.
Both, but let me ask you a question.
Yes.
This example.
Yes.
Was there a particular reason that the object was placed in the first place? Did they say whether it was too heavy to carry, or was there a reason or he just aimlessly left it there?
There's various answers to that. It would be too complicated for us to discuss it here. There are various different scenarios that it could possibly be. The Mishnah is intentionally vague in order to allow room for further discussion and further detail. So in order to answer your question, we would have to take out the Talmud and have probably an hour-long class just on that. So I'll leave that. What?
So it would be pretty simple to cut. That it's just that it's public thoroughfare. You're not leaving it for the public to use would be an infringement, as the shop owner, and as they cite in the Talmud, I think, or wherever I read it, but that had fire outside, maybe he had his Hanukkah menorah outside in the public thoroughfare, and therefore he's responsible for the traffic that went by and got caught on fire because of his...
Okay. All right. So there's a lot more to talk about in terms of the Talmudic lesson here. Let me restate the moral lesson that we're deriving from, and that's the point. The point is, the moral lesson is, and that the Gemara is bringing out, that it is more incumbent upon a person to be careful not to damage others than it is not to damage himself. And this is explained very beautifully by one of the great Musar giants of previous generations, the Alter of Slobodka, that was Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, who was the mentor of Rabbi Ruderman, by the way, in Slabodka Yeshiva, Rabbi Ruderman, the founder of Neri Yisrael, and he explained it this way. He explained that if a person gets damaged, so it's a cut, it's a bruise, so he'll have to heal. It's a bruise to his body. It'll heal. It hasn't affected his humanity. It has not affected who he is, his character as a person. It's just been an injury to his body. If a person causes damage, then that is a bruise not only to the one who got damaged, but it's a bruise to his soul because he has been careless. And I'm not talking about, you know, an accident that's beyond his control. Something that he could have been more careful about. He has been careless with the way he treats others. That is a worse form of breakdown than it is to have a bodily injury. And therefore, the question, the objection was, why are we letting Reuven off scot-free that he doesn't have to pay for the drug? He should have been watching where he was going as it relates to damaging another person's property. When it comes to his own injury, we don't care so much if Reuven was reckless. Being reckless with his own well-being, it's serious. A person has to take care of himself, no question, but it's not as objectionable when a person is careless with his own well-being as it is when he's careless with others. Does that make sense? This is an important, we have to make sure we are all on the same page, because from here we go on to the rest of the class. So let's make sure that everyone understands this.
The act of leaving jug was to cause injury.
Yeah, so you're talking about from Shimon's standpoint, and the discussion we've had is just from the standpoint of Reuven. That's another question. Let's leave Shimon out of it for now. As far as Reuven is concerned, it's more objectionable that Reuven damaged the jug than it is that he got damaged himself. That's the observation that's being made. Let's just clarify this point.
Well, it sounds like the point here is damages, and whoever's responsible for the damage pays. So in the first case, Reuven damaged the jug, so he pays. In the second scenario, Reuven's the one who got damaged.
Good. Very
so
good.
Shimon pays.
Good.
So it's all focused
very
on
good.
The damage.
Okay, very good. That's a good way of putting it. In other words, it's more incumbent upon the damager not to do damage than it is about the defendant to defend himself or to protect himself. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I wasn't listening carefully enough in the beginning when you said what the Mishnah said.
Yeah.
I thought you said that Reuven was not responsible for breaking the jug.
Correct. And then the Gemara objected to that.
The Gemara objected, but since I'm not familiar enough with Mishnah and Gemara, I would have thought that Mishnah would be the final authority.
Well, actually, the objection overruled the Mishnah. The Gemara ended up giving an alternate interpretation of the Mishnah so that it wasn't in conflict with the objection. But the objection was actually correct. But I don't want to elaborate too much because that would be complicated. No, I say the objection was actually the final word. Yes.
A question comes to my mind on looking to see if the person that gets the damages himself, and we're putting less value on that than damaging somebody else, because we're saying hurting somebody else is really being not sensitive. But a person that is not sensitive to and has not been taught to be sensitive to himself, how is he going to be
sensitive to others?
I'm going like it's you know going underneath that.
That's a very good argument, and it could be that an insensitivity or a general recklessness to one's own well-being will result in being insensitive to others. It also could be not. It could be that a person, and you meet people like that, that are so more concerned about others' welfare than theirs. They're like the kind of people that will say, it's cold, take my sweater. Mm-hmm. I know somebody like that. She happens to be my mom. But she is more concerned about how she treats other people than how she treats herself. That's just the way she is. I mean, she's not careless, but she is more careful about that.
What I would say is that probably your mom was given such love and good values about how her importance was in the world as a Tzelem Elokim and as a good person, that she then could stand on that and do the next level, possibly.
Yes, yes. By the way, she does take care of herself better than a lot of people. It's not that she's careless. It's just that she's even more careful. The point that we bring out is as follows. Here we have Mishpatim. The Torah is filled with a legal system. And at first glance, you open it up and you say, the same thing in American civil law. Okay, now let's give credit where credit is due. The Torah civil code was the first one. So all the other civil codes probably borrowed from biblical law. But besides that, how do we view in America the function of our court system and our laws? If I polled 10 Americans on the street and said, why do we have laws? What will their answer be? To protect the individuals, okay? To protect people from lawlessness and vulnerability to criminals, either intentional or unintentional, to make sure that people who are hurt, who are damaged, will be protected by law. Their bodies will be protected, their money will be protected. How many Americans will say the purpose of law is to teach people how to be good human beings and how to be sensitive and careful with other people's property? How many people will say that the purpose of the mishpatim, of the laws, is for the sake of the would-be damager? 1 out of 10? 0 out of 10? Do you see the profound difference here? Torah is concerned with how people act for their own humanity, more so than the protection of the damaged person. Now, this may seem like kind of an esoteric point. Let me elaborate on this using Mesilas Yesharim. Chapter 19 is one of the chapters on the elements of piety. Piety is chassidus. We have discussed chassidus in classes before this year. In general, chassidus is like going beyond the requirement, beyond the letter of the law. Most people will say, don't talk to me about chassidus. I'm still working on the basics. But we explained, and I don't remember which parsha it was. Yes, I do. Chayesara. It was how we discussed the criteria that Eliezer used to find the proper wife for Yitzchak. He wanted to find a wife that had chassidus. And we explained over there, why are we so hung up on chassidus if it's such a high level? We pointed out that at the very beginning of the book, Rabbi Luzzatto says, I'm going to tell you the foundation of chassidus. Page 1, chassidus. Why? Because even though chassidus is a very high level to reach, but it's a very basic level in terms of what a model Jew should look like. A model Jew should look like a chassid. Put it this way, you would rather meet a chassid on the street if you were going to meet a Jew. Now you just give us an example. If I were to say, Arthur, one day you could be like that Jew at the Kotel, you're going to say, ho, 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 far be it from me. I'll be happy if one day I'll just be a tenth of that. And yet, he is the one that you were enamored by. He was the one that impressed you, not the people that were doing the basics. Because to you, that is the picture of a Jew. So, chassidus is important because that is what a model Jew looks like. Just want to give that preface to show that what we're learning about is not so high level. We're really talking about basics in terms of what a Jew should be. So take that in account when we discuss it.
We don't know that person's interaction with other people in society. All we know, he's at the Kotel, he's into Hashem. That's it. We do not know if this translates into any other aspect of his life in dealing with any other people in society.
And my point is not to hang up this person. I don't know this person. I wouldn't have mentioned it at all except that he made the idea. I was trying to bring out the point that we are struck when we see a person who strives for a higher level. I'm not using that individual as the picture of the chassid. But listen to Rabbi Luzzatto describe the chassid. I'm on page 116, the beginning of chapter 19. There are three fundamental elements of piety. The first relates to the deed, the second to its application, and the third to a person's intention. That's not so crucial for now. The first element of piety relating to the deed itself is subdivided into two parts. One concerning man's relationship to the divine presence between man and God, and the other concerning man's relationship with his fellow man. We're familiar with the two divisions of the mitzvos, Bein Adam L'Makom, between man and God, Bein Adam L'Chavero, between man and man. Now, I would expect that what's going to follow is a long elaboration of the mitzvos, Bein Adam L'Makom, between man and God. That's going to go on for several pages with all the details. And then, when it comes to between man and man, he'll probably say something like, your mother said, don't forget to be a mensch. That's not how he presents it. The first of these two concerning man's relationship to the divine presence entails the meticulous fulfillment of all mitzvos to one's maximum capabilities. Period. One more paragraph about that. It is the duty of the pious to add to the perfection of the mitzvos, not to reduce their proportions in any manner. Okay? This much space is devoted to the mitzvos between man and God. The next one, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs is devoted to man to man. And listen to what he says. The second of these two concerning man's relationship to his fellow man, and listen to these words as you look at Mishpatim. Remember what I told you. Mishpatim, as we learn from the Talmud, is concerned with my responsibilities as a human being, not to be a menace, not to be harmful, not to be careless with others. And I want you to color all the pages of Mishpatim with that premise. And this is going to elaborate on that. The second of these two, concerning man's relationship with his fellow man, deals with the measure of benevolence that a person should always bestow upon others, while at the same time he must ensure that no harm befalls them through him. This applies to their physical, financial, and spiritual well-being. With reference to their physical well-being, one must endeavor to assist all people as much as possible and to ease their plight. This is what we have been taught, Pirkei Avos 6:6, and to share the burden of his fellow. If he can prevent any bodily harm that threatens another person or eliminate it after it has materialized, he must exert himself to do so, i.e., clearing the path of jugs and the like. In the financial domain, one should give financial assistance to another person as far as one's resources allow, and in whatever way possible, he should prevent any harm from befalling him the other. Surely one must avoid causing any type of damage that could result in harming others, whether individually or collectively. And even if at the moment no damage is foreseen, nonetheless, since this is a possibility, he should remove and eradicate any potential cause of damage. Furthermore, our sages of blessed memory have said, Pirkei Avos 2:12, the money of another person should be as precious to you as your own. In the spiritual domain, spiritually, one must try to do whatever one can to bring satisfaction to another, whether the issue is one of honor or whether in other areas. The performance of any deed that one knows will please another is included in the mitzvah of piety. If I can do a deed that will bring pleasure to another person, it is a mitzvah of piety, on the level of piety, for me to do that. And of course, one must be careful not to cause hurt of any kind to anyone in any manner whatsoever. The underlying principle in all of these categories is that of gemilus chasadim, acts of kindness. The sages of blessed memory have greatly extolled its virtue, as well as our duty to carry it out. Also included in this mitzvah is the pursuit of peace, which refers to the general attitude of benevolence that should prevail between any two people. And then he goes on to bring examples from the writings, the Talmud, the Midrash, of both areas of piety. But you notice that he spends more time talking about piety in the area of man to man than he does on the other areas. And the bottom line is, I should help people and God forbid I shouldn't hurt them. Any comments? Okay. So, that is the essence of Mishpatim. When it says in the Torah, Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem, and these are the ordinances that you shall place before them, and Rashi says, before them, v'lo lifnei goyim, these are not the laws that are used by the non-Jews, even if you know that they happen to share common laws with you, don't go to their courts. stay in your own courts. Even if you know they have the same laws, then what's the difference? What's the difference between a Jewish court and a non-Jewish court? The difference is in the attitude. The difference is in the purpose. The purpose of the laws is to make me a better human being, not to protect my rights or to make sure that I get paid back if somebody hurts me. That's secondary. Primary is I should learn how to be a chassid, to be pious when it comes to other people. And I think this is borne out in the famous story of Hillel and a convert. I'm sure you've heard this one before. There was an incident involving a certain Gentile who came before Shammai and said to him, "Convert me to Judaism on condition that you will teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot." Upon hearing these words, Shammai pushed the person away with the ruler he was holding in his hand. I believe that's figurative. And that's it. Undeterred, the Gentile came before Hillel and presented him with the same request. Hillel converted him. Before the conversion, Hillel said to him, "That which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow." This, in a few words, is the entire Torah. All the rest is but an elaboration of this one central point. Now go and learn it. This is Shabbos 31a. Two questions here. Why would he say that this is the entire Torah? This, of all things, he didn't say anything about lighting the Shabbos candles, or about prayer, or about tefillin, or about Shabbos. And second of all, my Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg, of blessed memory, used to ask the question, you know, the Christians also have the golden rule. How does that go?
Do unto
others as you have them do unto you. Supposedly, that's a quote from Hillel. Is it the same?
No.
Why?
One's in the positive, one's in the negative.
One's in the positive, one's in the negative. So if Hillel didn't say it in the positive, that which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow, then there must have been a reason. Rabbi Weinberg said, sure, because my biggest preoccupation when I wake up in the morning and go outside is that I shouldn't hurt somebody. That's my first preoccupation. Just like we learned, I should be careful, I should watch where I'm going so that I don't hurt someone. More than that, I shouldn't get hurt. That I shouldn't hurt someone else. Before I start doing good deeds and start saving the world with my charity or my... First and foremost, don't be a mazik. Don't damage anyone. And as Rabbi Luttazzo says, that means bodily, financially, and spiritually. Take it from Hillel. Hillel said to this Gentile, this is the essence of the Torah. The most important lesson I can teach you is don't hurt people. There you have it. You have it in the Mishpatim. It's the first parsha after Matan Torah. You have it in the Mesilas Yesharim, in the elements of piety. The largest discussion revolves around this area of piety. And you have it right here in the story with Hillel. So that's really basically it. We should walk away from Parshas Mishpatim, not burdened by a set of laws, but we should walk away inspired and enlightened that this is really what God has in mind for the Jewish people. To be excelling not simply because we talk to God more or because we do more mitzvahs, but excelling in the way, in our humanity, in the way that we look at other people and put ourselves in their shoes and say, I wouldn't want to be hurt. I'm going to be careful today not to hurt other people. That is the essence of the Parsha, and that is indeed the essence of the Torah.
Go ahead.
Shabbat.